We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air. We're Dads on the Air.
Welcome to Dads on the Air for the 7th of April 2009. Personally, I've had a rotten tooth for the last week, so I'm feeling very miserable. I hope you're all feeling a bit better than I am. Should be an interesting show. We've got Archbishop Barry Hickey. He's from WA, Western Australia, and he'll be talking about the absence of fathers in modern society and the impact that it's having, and he's written quite a bit of material on how he hopes that fathers will basically get back into their traditional roles, basically.
Be let back into the family.
Let back into the family. So that should be an interesting interview. We were going to have, and we may still have, Father Fighting Dave, who is a legendary Anglican priest and boxer who does a lot of work both with street kids and with general parishioners. It's a really lively character. Fortunately for him, he's just had a baby and he's in hospital with his wife. Oh, his wife's had a baby. So we're not quite sure whether he'll make it onto the program or not. We're just hoping he will. And we'll have some other material as well, just looking at recent claims that fathers are happy with the family law reforms. This follows a judgment where a woman in Tasmania had her kids taken off her because she was allegedly discouraging a relationship with the father. And the kids were promptly taken off her and given to the father who lived in Melbourne. So that was a very surprising judgment, certainly from the family court, and we'll be taking a look at that. First up, we'll do a bit of news. Here's one story. This is from Perth, from the Sunday Times in Perth. Shame of the Battered Husband by Linda Cann. Men are being stabbed, punched and scalded with hot food and water by abusive partners, the first study of its kind in WA has confirmed. Researchers at Edith Cowan University, and they do some terrific work, including some great work on the operations of the Child Support Agency, say domestic violence goes both ways, though female and male assaults are rarely acknowledged. The extent of the problem is underestimated because many men are too ashamed to come forward, say lead researcher Alfred Allen. Shame is something we've come across quite regularly, Professor Allen said. Males won't easily admit abuse because it seemed to be not manly and they feel they wouldn't be believed. The Australian Bureau of Statistics estimates 33,200 West Australian men may have experienced violence at the hands of a partner. One participant in the Edith Cowan study told the Sunday Times he escaped 2 years of physical and psychological abuse by his former partner. The 45-year-old man said he could not retaliate against the drunken rages. She would charge around the house and beat the daylights out of me night after night, he said. I would run out of the house and seek refuge in the car. The slightest thing would trigger her off. Once she saw a kitchen item out of place and went nuts, chasing me around the house and hitting me with any object, punching and kicking me. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there that might just relate to this story. About 20 to 30% of domestic violence is inflicted on men, Men's Advisory Network Executive Officer Gary Bryant said. It's a very controversial issue no one wants to talk about, he said. And Department of Community Director General Susan Barra acknowledged men were victims of domestic violence, but she claimed research indicated women were more commonly victims than men, the perpetrators. Well, there is a lot of other studies which indicate that that domestic violence is not the gendered crime that so many advocates would like to think it was. Look, we should introduce everyone in the studio today. We're a bit depleted today, yes, but some of us are here. There's
that's
Ian.
Right.
Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Thank you, John, and good morning, everybody.
And Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Ian. Good morning, everyone.
And don't forget, you can listen to this show later at dadsontheair.net, and if you wanted to listen to us via live streaming, you go to the 2GLF website. Some more news, Ian.
Oh, well, I've actually got some great news here. This is fabulous news in the Telegraph on the weekend. Al Halliwell writes under the heading, Boom in Bust Sizes for Aussie Women, L. Halliwell has written. The bra market is expanding, literally. Up to 40% of Australian women now buy bras with a cup size of double D or higher. New figures from lingerie suppliers show. In the 1950s, the most common bra cup size was B, three sizes less than a double D. Modern breasts are getting so large that some bra companies have introduced cup sizes as high as K. Experts blame the cleavage boost on obesity, contraceptive pills, and artificial hormones. As women's chests have grown, the number of breast reductions have doubled in the past decade, said cosmetic surgeon Mark Goyen. There's definitely been an increase, said Dr. Goyen, who runs Sydney Surgery, the Alia Clinic. I was doing about 10 to 15 female breast reductions a year. Now I'm doing 20 to 30, which sounds like it's doubled to me. There's no question that because the population is bigger, their breasts are bigger as well, because it's all fatty tissue. Larger, more cumbersome breasts often discouraged women from exercising, said body image expert Jenny O'Day, associate professor at the University of Sydney's Faculty of Education and Social Work. Dr. O'Day said that makes it even harder to lose weight and can lead to further increases in breast size. Perish the thought. Well, I can think of the kind of exercise that those young, large-breasted women should be getting up to keep themselves in trim, but as this is a family program, I will not elaborate.
Well, I think we're fully abreast of that.
Oh, what a witty thing you are.
Okay.
Yes, a vital issue, really. More than a mouthful.
Let's put vital.
Vital issue, vital statistics that we need to keep across. Most important that we come across these issues, we bring them to the public's attention.
Yeah, bugger family law and child support. Let's get to the nitty gritty.
Let's talk about tits.
All right, guys, let's get back to the family law, eh?
Bugger,
I know. I'm a party pooper.
Yeah, okay. Go on then, Phil.
Thanks, matey. Listen, just this report is from Canada, and I guess it shows that, you know, the feelings around sole custody and the damaging that it does to the child is beginning to be a global issue. This is from the Toronto Star, from Suzanne Pigg, who is the Living reporter.
P-I-G.
P-I-double-G.
Okay.
Just like those bras, double-G.
Double-G pigs now. Yes, and double-D bras. Double-G pig and a double-D bra, perhaps.
Maybe. She's certainly a star in Toronto. Family court judges are misguidedly harming children by granting sole custody to one parent, usually the mother, in bitter divorce battles, says a comprehensive new report. Too many children are being robbed of the love of one parent by a legal system that is out of touch with the needs of children and treats them like property to be won or lost, said Edward Cruck, an expert in child custody issues.
Cruck with a double K, perhaps?
Well, one at the front and one at the back.
They told you.
There you go. The system is set up to polarise parents, to make them enemies, and to set up fights over custody and exacerbate conflict rather than reduce it, says Cruck.
And this is supposed to be news, isn't it?
Well, it is, mate,
in
Toronto.
It's been going on for 50 years, mate.
But, you know, absolutely, mate, and I agree with you there too, but, you know, I guess the thing is that it's finally making the papers. It's there in black and white. It's there for people to see, and I guess it's there for people that are living in intact relationships.
Who don't know, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, who haven't been down that road yet and they can see, you know, maybe if their situation worsens and they end up separating, you know, they might have the heads up. So
there's so little sympathy, isn't there, between people in intact marriages and separated blokes.
Yeah, you know, in Dads in Distress we often meet guys, you know, and they've come in and they're really fresh, you know, they've just separated in the last week or two, you know, and they go, I never knew it was going to be like this, you know, there's all these people hassling me and all I want to see is my kids and she won't let me see them.
Oh yeah, look, and I remember before I separated and had any of those problems, having a friend of mine went through it and through the family court, and I remember running into him at barbecues and stuff and him just kind of cornering you and letting you have all this woes and she did this and what a bitch she is. And I remember in those days just thinking, yeah, mate, you know, get over it sort of thing. And then I went through it. Now I have a whole different perspective on what he was trying to tell me, what he was trying to prepare me for. Because until you go through it, people, you haven't got a clue.
No.
You really can't imagine what it is like to lose everything.
No. It's, you know, we often equate it to it's like a death in the family.
And if you do go through it, then you claim to be biased if you talk about it. So.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back shortly.
so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we have the honour of having on the show with us today Archbishop Barry Hickey from Western Australia. Very welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thank you very much.
It's an honour to have you on the show. Look, you stand out as being one of the few senior church figures who have spoken out about fatherhood in Australia. Why do you think so few speak out as you have?
I really don't know. I would say most of the bishops, at least, would be on side with me. Maybe they haven't been asked. I couldn't say, but I come in contact with so many broken families and so many families where the father is absent, and I see the damage that's caused, unfortunately. So I thought it was time to talk out, and also because marriage seems to be not as popular as it was once, and I don't think the alternatives are that good for the children, especially if dad's not there.
No, it's been a very, well, we all went, anyone like myself who went to university in the Sydneys, in the 70s, was, you know, the family was described as, you know, an oppressive patriarchal unit which benefited the male and kept the women and children imprisoned, and, you know, so there's been a lot of sort of supposedly progressive ideology shoved down our throats, which has been very anti-father.
That's true. I went to one of the local universities, or UWA, in the 70s as well, and I banged into the same ideology. Never rang true then, it still doesn't.
But it is, 30 years later, I mean, they're still getting it crammed down their neck, even more so than we did, I think.
Oh, is that so? Yeah.
Oh, I think
It's time to appreciate again the family and the permanence of the family and the benefit for children, especially if dad's involved. Mum's going to be involved, but if the dad's not there, or if they're not in contact with the dad, there's damage done.
Oh, we couldn't agree more here.
Good on you.
So, what you've said in some of your articles that the absence of fathers in Australia is worse than the scourge of drugs. What can you talk about what you think the impacts are? What you're seeing?
We face lots of disasters around us, of course, like drought and the current recession and all that, and they all cause damage. But I think what's happened is something's happened to the basic unit of society, the family. We have a rise in cohabitation where the couples don't get married. And so, honestly, their commitment to each other is not as strong as the marriage commitment. Children get born out of wedlock, and the mums usually look after the children, and they have an uphill battle, and they needn't have that uphill battle, really, if dad was involved. There's a lot of violence that comes from young boys whose relationship with their father is very ambiguous. Either he's not there, or he's there, but he's at work all the time and doesn't spend time with the child. And adolescents grow up not sure of their own sexual identity at times, or if they are, they tend to resent that they haven't had that male adult figure in their lives and become depressed and suicidal or violent and antisocial or get mental health problems. I've also looked at the research on this, and that comes up again and again and again regarding adolescent males and their rebelliousness, and there's some link with the family, with the father and his absence. So I think we should take that seriously as a society and start promoting the benefits of marriage again.
I think it's amplified too by the fact that a lot of the local manufacturing that for adolescents, you know, a lot of them coming off the housing estates and so on, in the old days they would get a job at the local garage or the local factory and there'd be some old codger there who would, you know, biff them around the head and pull them into shape and give them some advice about being a man, you know. None of this is happening anymore.
I think that's very true. We don't look after our young youth, the young males, the way we used to. Girls also have their problems. If they haven't got a father figure, they need that reassurance. They need the balance between male and female. So I'd like to say that what I'm promoting is marriage and family life, and especially from the children's point of view. But also the sort of family I'd be promoting is where a strong commitment is made right from the very beginning, where there is love between father and mother or husband and wife, where there is real care for the children. If you have all those ingredients, you're a winner. If something goes wrong, and lots of things do go wrong, the marriage doesn't last that long, and there's bitterness and anger, we've got to, as a society, see that that does damage and try our best to support marriage and keep people in that permanent relationship as far as possible, and a loving relationship to boot.
Yes, it's fairly true to say that in the last 50 years, the institution of marriage has been taken out of the churches and put in the courtroom. The church Yep. used to marry people, and that was considered for life. They couldn't separate without the blessing of the church. Now, of course, that's all out the window. There's civil unions. People don't need to profess any kind of faith at all. You can basically swear your marriage vows on a cooking book if you want to. How does a church feel about that? I mean, this must be a huge erosion of your input into society, into social values. I mean, has the church got any plans of trying to claw this back?
I don't think we've got a plan out there. We've got a strong desire. But we have our Bishop's Committee for Family and for Life that are issuing statements, trying to offer a different ideology from that of the world. But it's not a very successful plan at the moment. It's there. And it's people have to speak out strongly and be able to get into the media and put a voice that's not often there. You know, I think of some of the talkback shows on television where it's very, very trendy indeed, and anything traditional like marriage and fidelity and these things get laughed at a bit. We have a plan to counteract it, but I hope this phone call is part of some sort of a reawakening to the need for society to stabilize the families and for people to get married on the basis of love and fidelity and stick with it.
Well, there are so many images now that are against it, aren't they? Even Madonna just shopping for another child in Malawi, you know.
Yes.
It's just
freshly separated from her husband as well.
But that hasn't stopped her going off and, you know, getting another bauble.
Buying more children, yeah.
Yes, you have to be concerned that the child might not be going into any sort of stable relationship. The child might not have a father and a mother that they can look up to and grow into those roles of male and female as they should. I think there are all sorts of difficulties in that. And yet, children seem to be a commodity for parents, single or married, rather than the fruit of the love between husband and wife. There's a whole different ideology that has to get back into the public realm again.
So in religious terms, I mean, is this Armageddon? I mean, isn't this what Revelations is talking about? Breakdown of the family, you know, number of the beast tattooed on, barcodes on everybody. You know, is this where we're going? I mean, does this look like the prophecies are becoming fulfilled?
Not really. I think it's a lack of awareness. We concentrate on other things. We concentrate on individual rights at the expense of children's rights. So we like to give people every possible freedom that they can have. I think that's a wrong ideology. Rights and responsibilities go hand in hand. It's not Armageddon. When we start realizing the damage that happens because of this, then society, we'll look for laws, we'll look for incentives, we'll look for other ways of protecting the family and giving it a good go. And some of the ideologies that arose up in the 70s should disappear quietly. I mean, the family has survived a whole lot of isms, you know, communism, or Marxism, now
feminism,
materialism. Now we've got lots of other individualism. It will survive, but a lot of damage will be done until we realise how important it is.
Well, it's a broader thing too, isn't it? I mean, I was just reading a recent article by Melanie Phillips, who's a columnist over in Britain, and she's talking about how the whole society has moved against Christianity. She's pointing out a case, a Christian council worker was suspended for encouraging a terminally ill woman to turn to God. And he was told it was inappropriate to talk about God with a client, and that he should not even say God bless, you know, which is a pretty harmless phrase. So he gets the sack for that. And this followed the case of a nurse who was also suspended for offering to pray for an elderly patient's recovery, the Christian who lost her role on an adoption panel because she disapproved of gay adoption, which is a fairly standard view, and Christian adoption agencies, which have lost their public funding because they had the same approach. Do you think there's a whole broad undermining of the sort of core Christian elements of our culture?
I do. I think that what's happened is that religion has been sidelined from mainstream politics in many countries, including Australia, but some have gone to extremes in the case, as in the cases you mentioned. And there seems to be a particular rejection of Christianity because it stands for things like marriage and fidelity and love and life. And they're not popular. So that people who get into positions of power call it discrimination if a Christian stands up for his or her beliefs. We have to do that. I know I personally have to do that because a lot out there would like to see me go away. So I've got to keep on standing up for what I believe, and I think it is good news, not bad news, that I stand for. So I think Christians should realize that they are under persecution. It's not a persecution of violence or arms or death, as it happened in, as still happens in some countries, but it is a persecution of exclusion, of being not given a voice in society. And yet Christians have as much a voice as anybody else in society and should use it. But I think you're right that discrimination is there against Christians in particular. Other religions might be given some sort of respect, but there's a rejection of Christianity because it stands in contrast with many of the modern ideologies. And one of the central ones is the respect for the sacred nature of the family.
You could also say that about Islam, and Islam does appear to be on the rise. Islam does have strict family values, has very strict code of how you know, husbands, wives, children should all react to each other, and they do worship the same God. I mean, why do you think Islam seems to be getting ahead in the religious, you know, stakes over Christianity? What would be the reason for that, in your opinion?
I think we've gone a bit soft. Christians as a whole have gone a bit soft and compromised all down the line, whereas Islam hasn't compromised at all. When these big international family conferences are held, or conferences on population and so forth, Islam and the Vatican seem to stand together on family values. But Islam has got a power of conviction that Christians in many cases have lost because they've made too many compromises.
But you could also say that Islam has compromised with Satan, I mean, with the other side. I mean, you know, Osama bin Laden's, all of these people strapping bombs to themselves and blowing themselves and everybody else up in the name of God, which is, you know, to a Christian is an absolutely ridiculous proposition.
It has. Not all of Islam, but there is a violent edge that can't be denied.
There certainly is.
Yes.
Which doesn't exist in Christianity. Gentle Jesus has nothing to do with strapping a bomb to yourself. There's no way you could construe love thy neighbour, do unto others as a call to arms.
No, certainly not. There's nothing in the Christian religion that is about turning into violence. I mean, Christians have been violent in the past, and maybe some will be in the future, but that's not our way. Our way is one of peace and love. Yes, Islam has got a violent edge, but we hope that in the international mix they will see that diplomacy and negotiations might be a better way. Maybe I'm hoping for something that's not going to happen.
Well, look, Melanie Phillips is more or less on exactly the same subject in her most recent article. She describes the resignation of Michael Nasir Ali, he's the Bishop of Rochester, as a terrible blow, not just for the Church of England, but for Britain. She says the bishop says he is resigning so that he can work for the endangered and beleaguered Christian minorities, both abroad and in the UK. And what a shocking rebuke to the Church, she writes, that he has to leave his post of influence and authority as a bishop in order to carry out the Church's core duty to defend its own against attack. Shocking but hardly surprising. Across the world, in countries such as Nigeria and Sudan, millions of Christians are being persecuted at the hands of militant Islam, with forced conversions, the burning of churches and widespread violence. But we never hear anything about any of this at all.
No, we don't. It's not out there in the public forum. I get quite a bit of information about the persecution of Christians in some Muslim countries, so I know it's on. But talking about Australia, we haven't experienced it to any great extent yet. But when it comes to certain core values, we have something in common that should be fostered.
You would think so.
I mean, I'm talking about the family and the sanctity of marriage.
I suspect
not the violent side.
I suspect some of the level of conflict is fairly well covered up. I mean, you can't find simple statistics like how many Christian churches are vandalised each year, for instance. And you'd think those sort of statistics would be readily available, but I haven't seen a journalist be able to find the exact figure.
Yeah. Well, there are, because the Catholic churches in all these countries and. Recently, a priest and two deacons were shot in Iraq, and I know some of the students who studied for the priesthood with them in Rome. So there's a lot of that stuff around, but as you say, it doesn't get into the mainstream media.
Look, we've somewhat drifted off the subject of fathers, so we might just take a quick break and come back and we'll talk about fathers.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
Know of the original sin, and you might know how to be with fire, but did you know of the murder committed in the name of love? Yeah, you thought we'd have been dead. Dream on, white boy. Dream on, black girl, black girl. And wake up to a brand new day. To find your tears are washed away. There was a time when I did not care, and there was a time when the facts did stare. There is a dream, and it's held by many. Well, I'm sure you have to see its open arms. Dream on, white boy. Dream on, black boy, dream on, white girl.
Dads in Distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're talking with Archbishop Barry Hickey from Western Australia. Welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Thank you very much.
Now, have you noticed the impact of family breakdown in your own parish? What have you seen?
Well, I've seen a lot. I was, I'm still very close to the welfare scene. I studied social work at university, and so I'm in touch with a number of our agencies and other agencies that look after children who are the products of broken marriages. Well, I've seen and spoken to many fathers who are absolutely distraught that they can't see their kids, all sorts of excuses given to prevent them. Now, some of these fathers aren't perfect. They're a bit violent, and one can understand restrictions put onto them. But they're violent because their whole lives have been turned around. The effect of family breakdown on children, yes, I've seen that and see that constantly. There was a meeting recently where the statistics of children in care in Western Australia were given. Now, I can't remember them all, but they've risen enormously and they keep rising. I was in the area myself of family placement before I was a bishop, and the numbers of children in care since those days has risen in a frightening manner. Children in care go into foster care. Many foster care placements are okay. Many break down. The children go to another foster care place or an institution, and those children themselves, and I know many of them, don't know what life's about. They're confused. They're angry. Their self-esteem is low. They got substance abuse many times. They're precocious sexually as soon as they hit puberty. Many of them turn to crime. But I think mental health problems and depression are probably the greatest factors. It is a very, very bad scene, and it's what happens when families break down at the rate that they're breaking down today. Could I tell you a little bit about some of the families I see? And these are Aboriginal families who are absolutely homeless. They're still young people. They live around my house on the front veranda and the back veranda, and I rarely get a good night's sleep, and last night was no different. But these young people, I talk to them and try to be friends with them and talk about their families. And I say, where's Dad? Or, haven't seen him for years. Or, I don't know who he is. This sort of thing. Mum's around. They know Mum. Mum does her best. But they break loose and they're out in the streets. A lot of the girls get pregnant. They know the father. But it's a very, very short-term relationship. Perhaps weeks. They have their baby. Welfare takes the baby away straight away. And they're out in the streets again. And I wonder where the fathers are. There are men there too who are confused about where they're going in life, no motivation, don't want to work, don't think they can work, don't think anyone loves them, they get rejected every day. It is a situation to which I have no answer. I just offer friendship if I can and a listening ear. But that's the bottom of the rung. But there are other levels in society where the effect of marriage breakdown and family breakdown is still characterized by exactly the same elements, but they're not on the street. They've got somewhere to live. It's a sad situation, and I think that the union of father and mother, of dad and mum, is still the best, and we should strive for it. And if dads get violent and the rest, then they need help. But the kids need both dad and mum. So we keep saying that and hope that society realises that and takes steps to affirm the importance of marriage, and that gets into the pop culture too, so that sex is not seen to be some sort of a weekend or daily relaxation. it is part of a commitment and a lifelong commitment to a deep relationship of marriage. That's the vision.
That's the vision, but the pop culture appears to be stampeding as quickly as it can in the opposite direction from all of those ideals.
You've just got
to read magazines, teenage magazines, dolly magazines for girls and stuff, and it's all about how to have more orgasms and how to be more sexy, and you know, and you know, the whole pop culture is heading towards this cheap, nasty, you know, instant thrills, instant gratification, shallow, meaningless society. I mean, how can we turn that around?
Yeah, the only people who can turn that around are families themselves, by father and mother saying, don't listen to all that nonsense, listen to us, and they also have to give the example. That is a far more powerful influence than the media.
Yes, but a bit of an
example of fathers and mothers. But if they don't give that example, the kids are lost.
Sure, but I mean, traditionally, kids, like teenagers, are rebelling against their parents. That's when you need the community to step in and reinforce those homegrown values, to let the children know that these values are absolute. It's not just something mum and dad dreamed up, that this is actually the way that we live, and there are good reasons for us living like this, because it means, you know, we can be productive and we can have communities that are harmonious, and, you know, where people feel safe.
Absolutely. And churches have the same mission to bring people together, to give them awareness of God, you know, the fatherhood of God in particular, as a loving person and important in their lives that they can turn to. So churches do have a role in bringing families together to assist them carry out that role. Children do rebel, but they've always rebelled. But they don't lose the values that they learnt in their younger years. They come back and say, Dad always says this, Mum always says that, and form pretty good families. But today, if the family they come from is all over the place, then those values don't get passed down.
Do you see the whole push for gay marriage and for a broader sort of definition of families? I noticed in an article in Perth that you were attacked by the gay lobby over your Christmas message, which was very pro-fathers and pro-families, and they were saying it's disappointing the Archbishop has chosen to focus on just nuclear families rather than also celebrating a diverse range of families, blah blah blah. What do you think about all this? Do they have a point, or is it
They might have a point insofar as they feel that they've been badly treated by history. But when it comes to marriage, you know, I have to continue to say that marriage is between a male and a female, a man and a woman, for life, entered into for life, and open to children. And that is not the sort of relationship between two gay people. There are lots of forms of friendship, lots of forms of close friendships. Close friendships are fine, but when it comes to marriage, I don't think it's in anybody's interest to change the definition of marriage for male and female. That seems to be what nature wants. It's certainly what the Bible teaches. It's certainly the experience of humanity that central unit is basic. So we shouldn't tamper for it. If they criticize it. Me for it, well, I suppose I've got to stand up and say, well, this is...
You'll survive.
I'm trying to tell the truth, and that gay people certainly have their close friendships and their love for one another, but it's not the definition of a family and a marriage. So I have to keep saying that.
Right. Do you think that the family level of family breakdown that we're seeing now impacts more on the underclass or the lower classes, the people that are hanging around where you are, or do you think it impacts right through the middle classes as well?
I don't have figures on that, but breakdown affects every class. It's something to do with, I think... stability, emotional and psychological stability, and what is needed to make a successful marriage. Whether that's a class thing or not, I have no idea. I would think that the people who've learned love and respect and honor from their parents, whether they're at the bottom of the economic ladder at the top, carry those values into marriage, and those who have had a disturbed background find it difficult because you know, they inherit all sorts of problems through instability, and that will be carried into their marriage, and there are elements of instability in that from the beginning, not impossible to overcome. But I don't know if it, I have no evidence that it's a particular economic strata.
And do you, when you say you come across fathers who are heartbroken, of course, but not being able to, absolutely heartbroken, as we know very well from this program, is there any advice that you offer them or anything you can say to them? We hardly know what to say to some of them. It's just so difficult.
No, I think they have to hang in and do what they can to be a good influence in the lives of their children. I don't know if they'll ever get back to their spouse again. That is a very, very difficult thing, especially if there's been subsequent remarriage and that. But the children need the father, even if he's out there alone. They need him. And so I just encourage them to keep trying. And the family courts need to acknowledge that too, that the kids need their father. They need their mum too. No one's questioning that, but they need their father. So just hang in and do the best you can and be a good father when you see the children. They'll take note of that. And they won't be saying to me, Dad, never see him. If it's possible for him to manage to keep in touch with the children, it makes a big difference in their lives.
So central to the, just a last general point that I'd like to make here, very central to the Christian doctrine is this notion of God the Father.
Yes.
Could you speak to us about what this actually means, what this means, because it is an analogy. But, you know, what does this mean about God himself and what does it mean about fathers? How does this analogy of God the Father apply? If you could just speak a little bit about that.
Yes, I'll try to. You know, in the Hebrew scriptures, God was really called Father. There are one or two instances. God was beyond all gender. God was God. And his very name was so sacred they couldn't write it out in full. All that. He was transcendent, but loving, nevertheless. But he also punished. In the New Testament, Jesus said that extraordinary thing. He asked us to take as our Father, his Father. He spoke to his father as Abba, almost like Dad, and he was conscious of his the heavenly fatherhood of God, being God's son. And he asked us to consider God as our father. I think the implications of that are that we do have, in a spiritual sense, a loving heavenly father. Even if life collapses around us, and our own father is absent, perhaps through death, perhaps through other circumstances, he's not there, we still have a father who loves us. And being loved is part of healthy growing up. And if we lack the love of our parents, at least we can be assured that somewhere there's a fatherhood of God in which we are loved. So I think it's that. It's a father who doesn't punish, a father who understands, a father who stands beside us and who's strong and calls us to live a good life. So to me, fatherhood is important, and the fatherhood of God is something that came from Jesus. And we do know it's an analogy. Father, God is pure spirit, no gender in God. We know that. But in practice, we are human. We look for terms that we can use to describe a loving God. And Jesus said, he's my father. Let him be your father too, and see what a difference that will make in your life.
Well, that's a rather good note to end up on. Is there any final points you would like to make?
Look after the kids. I think that we should have a look at how many children are going into care throughout the whole of Australia. That is an indication of what's happening to married life and family life today. If we suddenly get frightened by that, we'll agitate to get a better deal. not just looking after those children, they must be looked after, but trying to prevent children going into care by advocating marriage and by supporting marriage in every possible way. That's the preventive way of looking after children, because families can do much better than the state can.
We've had the honour of having Archbishop Barry Hickey from Western Australia on to Dad's on the Air. Thank you so much for coming onto the show.
It's been a pleasure.
No, thank you so much.
And a happy Easter to you.
Thank you very much. God same bless. To you. Bye. On the line, the legendary Fighting Father Dave. Are you there?
I mean, I don't know how legendary I am, but I'm here.
Well, you make a fair bit of noise, enough to get noticed. Well, congratulations, you're now a father for the fourth time.
Yeah, you worked it out. That's good. I'm having trouble counting at the moment. I'm a bit bleary and tired, and it's been a long night.
Oh, I thought we'd lost you and you weren't coming on the show. And I'm thinking, maybe he seemed keen. Where did he go?
Yeah. I'm back.
Boy or girl?
A girl.
Ah, good. So you've got how many of each now?
Three girls and a boy now.
Oh, well, there you go. You might stop at that then.
Yeah, well, this is it. You know, I'm trying to work out how it happens. It's a bugger, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it's a great mystery. One of God's mysteries, no doubt.
Yeah, I guess that's it, yeah. I think that might be the end, but yeah.
So, well, what, all the boxing's on the back seat now, is it?
Well, mate, this is, I'm just thinking about that. I've got a little kids coming over for boxing tonight and the youth centre this afternoon, and I think I'm back on deck. I don't think I've got anyone to cover for me, so.
Right.
I could do with the night off, but I don't think so.
Oh, dear. So, when was the baby born? Yesterday?
Last night, yeah.
Last night. Oh, yeah. Wow. Amazing. What's her name?
I think, see, I wanted to call her Trinity, you see.
Mm.
But and then we thought first name Holly Trinity, it sounded good, but I don't think we'll do that to her. I think she may be named after her grandmother, Francesca.
Oh, yeah. Ooh.
Maybe Francesca Trinity.
The only Francesca I know is a bit of a rat bag.
Really? I'll keep that in mind. I'll let my wife know.
Yeah, a real rat bag. Oh, dear. So... can you just give our listeners a bit of a background of yourself, really, of just how you became a boxer before a priest? You became a priest, or
I actually became a boxer through having a marriage breakdown.
Right,
that's a connection.
Oh. Therapeutic, yeah.
Well, it was. It was therapeutic. That's exactly right. I mean, the truth is, I found after my marriage broke down, and I was already a priest by that stage.
Hmm.
I found I was drinking myself to sleep, and
yeah.
I thought, you know, I could see where that was going, and I thought, well, what's the other thing I enjoy doing is training, you know, so I got out and started training every spare minute I had, and ended up becoming a professional fighter rather than an alcoholic, so... I was going to say, you lose about the same number of brain cells, I think, but I think it was still a better choice.
Right. Well, it's probably good advice. I mean, a lot of the... because we started off as a bunch of pretty disgruntled, separated blokes, this program, and we've calmed down a bit over the years, I suppose. But
maybe, yeah.
But what advice can you offer? You know, there's a lot of dads that are still, you know, pretty distressed or going through it, you know.
Yeah, well, this is it, isn't it? And I mean, I've never, you know, I used to run a support group here with men battling to see their kids. And it's the most miserable group of life. You know, I mean, it's the hardest thing in the world.
Yeah,
you know? I don't think anyone understands what it's like to be broken down like that, you know, unless they've been through it. It's,
No, they don't get much sympathy, do they?
That's the trick. And you've got to do it, so you've got to survive for the sake of your kids. That's the thing.
Yeah.
That's what I always do tell dads, was just told to me, that, you know, men who attempt suicide, there's enormous correlation with the number of whose kids end up trying to do the same.
Really?
Yeah, it's an enormous percentage of where fathers have attempted suicide, their kids end up trying it too. And that's always the thing that stops us dads from, you know, pursuing those self-destructive thoughts, I think. It's a catch-22. Our love for our kids is what's killing us, but at the same time, it's actually what stops us killing ourselves.
And you want them to follow in your footsteps, but not like that.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I didn't realise that.
Yeah, no, it's an enormous correlation, and it's a really important stat to pass on to other men when we find ourselves in this situation, because it stops us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and often it's the only thing that does, because, I mean, the suicide rate in this country amongst men struggling for their kids is enormous. Yeah, terrible.
And outrageously, the government doesn't even count them.
Well, yeah.
You can't ask the government how many men have died this week or this month or this year. You know, most of them are child support agency clients, and they refuse to release the statistics.
Right. I mean,
how outrageous is that?
Look, there's a lot of well-known cases, you know what I mean? There's just a lot of pain out there amongst men, you know, who don't know what to do and who feel helpless and... feel they're trapped with a system that's favouring, you know, their former partner, and which often it is, you know. I mean, thankfully things are improving a little bit in this country, and they have improved a lot in this country.
They've improved to some degree, but... there's still a sort of acres of pain out there.
That's exactly right, and you can't measure that, you know.
It's just, and you know, you talk to the lawyers and the bureaucrats, and they all basically blame the litigants, you know, for being unable to reach an agreement. They just, you know, they just blame the client, basically.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. It's easy to, yeah, I think it's that feeling of helplessness. I mean, the legal system as such stinks, I think, and you find, I mean, it's ironic because we've just been in hospital and my wife was saying it's a similar sort of situation where all of a sudden you're surrounded by people who seem to know what's good for you, but you have a clue what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
And you're just all these medical people, they've got their own language, they're sort of mucking around with your body, and I mean, the court's worse. Yeah, they've all got their own language, they're doing their own thing, they're having a good time, and they're deciding your life, you know?
Yeah. Nope, yep. And you're inflicting things on you they'd never inflict on themselves.
Yep.
Yeah, just unbelievable.
No, it's a nasty and violent system, you know.
It truly is. How was that support group that you ran? Just, do you think it did any good for the guys? Or
look, I think so. Getting men talking is a really important thing, you know, and it doesn't happen often. I think this is part of the whole thing, is that women are used to talking with each other.
Oh, yeah.
And it's taken a long while for men to, I mean, just men to be able to own their feelings, you know what I mean? Mm. If they're, particularly if they're very negative and self-destructive, you know, and being able to say, look, you know, this is where I'm at. That's not a thing men have traditionally done, you know, in groups or even alone with their priest or anything, you know what I mean? It's,
they just don't talk. Yeah, we've got Phil York from Dads in Distress in the studio, and that'd be your experience too, wouldn't it, Phil?
Yeah, look, I'm a big fan
absolutely.
Of Dads in Distress, and
thanks, Father Dave.
Yeah, no. I think you do a fantastic job, you know, really do. And I've been mates with Tony Miller for some time, and love your work.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a vital work, and I mean, you're helping guys there on the edge, and the number of guys that are calling in and needing help,
Yeah, that's right, and you know, not only are we helping the dads, but in turn, through helping the dads, we're helping the whole family, you know.
Oh, of course.
And
community, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Everybody loses when dad dies, you know.
And I think lots of people actually disregard that fact, that, you know, by helping the dad, we're actually helping the whole family.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've never understood how, you know, hunting the dad into the ground and making all false allegations and taking all his assets and property and dignity is really helping the kids.
It's not. I mean, it just comes out of anger and out of abuse of power, doesn't it, you know?
Totally.
It's got nothing to do with being concerned for your little ones. It's just stupid.
No, and there's no public messages going out to women not to make false allegations or to make them aware of the damage that they're doing. You know, there's no public messages at all. It's all
as much as you can. Isn't that the nature of our litigious society too? I mean, people, you know, they're suing each other, they're front and centre if they think they can get a buck. You know, it's something very corrupt in our culture, I think.
Yes, and it seems to have got nastier and nastier in recent years to me.
Yeah, the law's become a weapon in the hands of unscrupulous people, unfortunately. And and the family court's a powerful testimony to that.
Very true. So, tell me, how you became a priest, and were you a boxer first or a priest first?
I was a violent young person first.
Very violent.
I was a violent teenager, you know, like an aggro idiot.
Yeah.
When I got converted, I actually moved away from all of that.
Mm.
And ironically, I came back to it later. Not in the form of violence, I don't think, but as using it in a totally different way.
How was it as a knockabout bloke converting to Christianity? Mm. Did everyone around you ridicule you and go, oh, he's gone soft in the head, or what? Hmm?
I lost all my friends.
All of them?
Yeah.
Literally?
Pretty much so. But you got to.
Yeah?
I work with a lot of teenagers, obviously, now, you know, and I mean, that's the key thing for getting a guy off the gear,
Get him out of the environment.
Yeah, out of drugs and that. You've got to break down. You've got to break his peer group.
And so you work with... you're still working with a lot of heroin addicts and so on?
It's not as much heroin now in this area, you know. I mean, we were
the lice now, isn't it?
In the West, not that long ago, well, 10 years ago.
Mm.
There's not that much here now. There's ice, and ice is a killer.
Sends them so mad, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a mad drug, you know, like it just like fries the brain and destroys people, rips them apart, you know. But, on the whole, we don't have the drug issues here we had 10 years ago, no way, you know. So just normal, more normal kid issues. Most of the violence issues we got here are with the girls, not with the boys at all.
And?
Yeah.
Please explain.
Well, yeah, it is. There's a lot of problems here with the girls. And see, I don't work as close with the girls, you know.
Yeah.
We run the boxing program. It works great for the guys. It just doesn't work the same way for the girls. So. And I'm not wanting to undervalue the significance of working with girls. I just need someone else to do it.
Right.
You know, it's not my area of expertise, unfortunately. You know, and I'm a guy with three girls, three daughters, you know. Mm. And my oldest daughter certainly had her struggles, you know, and I would love to be better placed to respond to that, but really what we do works best with boys, you know.
And what do you do exactly?
We teach them to fight.
So you
pretty
put them, you put them, this is what, once a week or twice a week or something?
Three times a week.
Three times a week, after school?
The youth centre runs every day, like after school. So that's
this is at Dulwich Hill, isn't it?
Yeah, and then we run the fight club at night three times a week. And, in addition to that, and one sort of, you know, moves into the other pretty seamlessly. So, but yeah, basically, I mean, look, some people talk about it as a form of anger management therapy, and you can do that, but basically we teach them to fight. In the process, of course, we teach them self-control, you know, and we're also breaking down their peer group and putting them into a different community, which is the real key.
Right.
You know, we're in a community which includes older men, which is quite bizarre, that when you find you've got this, in the fight club phenomenon, you've got younger boys, teenage boys, looking up to older men who are their mentors and trainers, you know.
And do you think this is something that is really lost with not so many fathers around these days everything?
I do. And I think, and with respect to, that's where I guess I'd part ways with the previous guest, who sounds like a lovely man. But for me, the issue's not just sort of trying to re-emphasise nuclear families. It's trying to re-emphasise the role of the broader community in bringing up boys.
Yeah.
You know, at least, I'm just talking about the boys I work with, and, well, boys in general, as against, I don't know how it works so with girls, but, you know, traditionally where you had the men of the community would help nurture the younger men into adulthood and that sort of thing, that's what we're lacking, I think, and that's what we're trying to do here, and particularly in a context where you've got, you know, who is my dad, I don't know, having other adult men around that boys can look up to and who will take an interest in them and play a role in mentoring them, I think that's the key.
What do you think about initiation?
Fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, look, you look back at traditional societies where you had a initiation ritual which boys would go through when they came of age, you know, and the adult men, again, would take those boys out into the bush or whatever and leave them out there for a week and they'd have to come back and, you know, show they were men, you know?
Yeah, they'd know that something had happened to them and there'd been a transformation.
Yeah, exactly. I think we get pretty close to that when, you know, often we get me and a guy's dad will take him out to the side of the ring, you know, and we'll throw him out there and say, all right, son, come back in three rounds' time, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you win, lose, or draw, show us you can stand on your feet and show courage and keep your cool under that amount of pressure, you know, and then we'll give you the keys of the car or, you know, now that we know you can, you know, handle power with control, you know what I mean? Now we know you can be trusted with that sort of power, you know, here you go. And frankly, I think if we did that, we'd have a lot less road deaths for a start.
Well, that's what being a man's all about, isn't it, really, is learning how to control your power.
Yeah, it's
being
learning to harness the power and control it.
Yeah, and use it for good in the community rather than...
Exactly. I mean, I think the current approach is just trying to repress it, you know, and or deny it altogether, you know, and I think that's part of the legacy.
No, that's wrong. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Maybe it's a sort of feminist legacy, but maybe it's just the natural response to the abuses of male violence, you know, male power.
Yeah, but a lot of that's a myth. Females are just as violent as men.
More so, I think.
Yeah,
too,
so,
you know?
So, you know, I mean, men have been tarred with an unfair brush there.
Totally. But having said that, I've got no place for male violence, but I think the problem is, the idea is not to repress it or deny it. The idea is to learn to control it.
Yeah.
You know.
And channel it into something positive.
Channel it into something positive. And that's exactly what we're doing with these boys, you see. We get them to get in touch with their aggression and to learn to control it and channel it. And as I say, the boys, the real fight isn't in the ring, you know. But once they've learnt to harness that energy, they can channel it somewhere worthwhile, you know.
And so how do these kids get involved? Do you pick them out? Or?
No, they just come along.
Yeah.
You know, we're well known. I think we've had every tough bastard in the area has been part of the fight club sometime or other in the last few years, you know.
Yeah.
Which is why I think we have no youth male violence problem in this area at all now.
Really?
No. I shouldn't say we take total credit for that, but I think it's got a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But look, this is the interesting thing I say with boys and girls. Boys join a fight club because they're angry most of the time, you know. They want to be tough, you know, they want to be men sort of thing, which is interesting because there's no parallel with the girls. If they join, it's because they want to get fit.
Yeah.
Or they're interested in the sport or something, you know, so it leads in a different direction. Most boys just join because, I say a fighter tends to need to have two things going for them. They've got to have a lot of energy needing release, and they've got to be not too concerned about their own health. And that works perfectly for, like, kids on the edge of the whole drug scene, prison system, you know, and also for men battling for their kids in custody cases.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Because what it lets out...
Well, you got a lot of energy involved and you really don't care too much about your own health.
Yeah.
You
know? So you push it up, put it all out there.
Yeah, you just channel, put it all out there, you know, get out of your system. And it's beautiful because it gets you to engage very intensely with other men in a very non-sexual way, you know, but in a very masculine way. You know, it's very affirming. And I always thought that's what fighting did for me first and foremost, was it made me feel comfortable with myself as a man.
Right.
You know, it made me feel good about that side of myself. Instead of feeling ashamed of my aggressive instincts, actually realizing, Mother Teresa had aggressive instincts, you know. Martin Luther King certainly did, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe this is why we got so many wimpy leaders in our society too, you know. Denial of the whole male aggression, you know, and the positive role it has to play.
Oh, they're all talking about reconstructing masculinity and all this sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah, well, there's something to be said for traditional, you know, masculine forms of aggression, rightly used and rightly channeled, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if you go back to the wisdom of the ancient Greeks, they spoke of the thymos as being like a one-third constituent of the human person, which was like the aggression, you know? Go back, read Plato's Republic, it's all there.
Yeah. All right, we're going to go to a quick break and we'll be back in a moment. We're talking with the legendary Fighting Father Dave. We'll be back in a moment.
Love is a battle.
so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're talking with Fighting Father Dave. Are you there?
I'm still here, John.
Now, before we get any further, we should mention your website, which is www.fatherdave.org.
That's it, brother.
Got Thanks. It right?
Yep, absolutely.
Great. Okay. So, look, the early church was actually seen as a destroyer of families, or was that was one of its labels. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah,
I find that really hard to understand or to follow.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you know, one of the great ironies that the church has been seen to stand for traditional nuclear families, in, at least in this culture, is that traditionally speaking, that wasn't the case. At least the church had a very ambiguous position on nuclear families. You go back, Jesus himself in the New Testament, when his family comes looking for him, he says, who is my mother, my father, my brothers, my sisters, you know. There's this sort of identification with the church community beyond just the sort of natural human family. And I think, yeah, the early church was known as often having a... The Romans loved the nuclear family. The church was seen as standing for something a bit bigger than that. And I think a broader sense of church community was what, took priority.
Right.
Yeah, personally, I think that's the key with working with kids is recognising, I think there are other models apart from the sort of traditional nuclear family that work. I think single-parent families can work. Mm. You know, I think having a broader range of men working with boys works, you know what I mean?
Right.
I think we've got to be creative in the way we allow ourselves to think about these things rather than just sort of stick with, well, that's the way it always is, you know? Nuclear families have their limitations, I think, and indeed the expectations that your one life partner is going to fulfill all your social, emotional, spiritual, sexual, everything needs, you know, I think is often a bit crazy.
Well, that's pretty ambitious, anyway, isn't it?
Well, the issue is, marriage as we have it is a social institution which I think has been developed for the benefit of bringing up kids in a stable environment. I think that's the goal. And I think that's the thing we've got to keep in mind as our focus. In the end, it's the welfare of the kids which is most important, you know?
But that's what we've lost the focus of, because now we're we're worried about our individual rights to go out
that's
and
right.
party and
that's
meet
exactly
lots of people
right.
and have lots of sexual partners. And
that's exactly right. And what we've got to get is, okay, well, what's going to create a stable and nurturing environment for the kids? That's number one.
But the other thing is, I mean, what's going to make us happy? I mean, are we going to be happy in this sort of life of flitting around the place, having different partners all the time, leaving our kids? Or is being part of a serious family that's held together with people who love each other and care about it, I mean, doesn't that create happiness?
Oh, look, I think so, but I think happiness is like a bonus. You know what I mean? I don't think marriage was ever dreamed up as an idea of how to make people happy.
Yeah, no, okay.
You know what I mean? I think, again, that's the sort of thing. Well, I'm not happy with my marriage. Well, are the kids in a stable, nurturing environment? You know, I think that's actually the most significant concern. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Again, the purpose of marriage wasn't simply to make you merry.
No.
You know, and I think people have got to come to terms with that. There's a lot of myths about it associated with the whole sort of, thing of romance and the rest of it that's all about finding a spiritual twin.
Well, we live in a world where basically you are encouraged to have what you want, to be a winner, to get, you know, what you want and have what you want and, you know, being a go with these great ideals and getting out there and conquering the world and getting everything your way. This is kind of presented to us, you know, which is basically just greed and selfishness repackaged.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's got nothing to do with the nurture of your kids, has it?
Absolutely
so, I mean,
nothing.
If we continue on that path, we can expect things to continue to collapse around us, I think.
So people are breaking up marriages. I mean, one survey showed that, you know, a lot of marriages, the only issue is really, you know, that they don't feel the earth moves anymore, you know.
Which is crazy. And yeah. I say, it reflects the fact that people have forgotten what marriage is about. You know, we didn't dream up marriage for the sake of making two people happy.
No.
You know, as I say, it's a social institution which is developed in its current form for the good of society as a whole, specifically for nurturing and care of children in a stable environment.
Look, we're running out of time. Any final word?
Mate, I don't know if I've got any final wisdom for you, John, but it's been great to be with you.
No, thank you very much. We've been talking with Fighting Father Dave. Hopefully we'll have you on when you're a bit more relaxed and haven't just... But congratulations on the birth of your latest
Thanks,
child.
Brother. Much appreciated.
Right. That was Fighting Father Dave, who's a legend here in Sydney. And thank you. Don't forget you can listen to this program at www.dadsontheair.net at your leisure. We'll be back next week talking about domestic violence in men.